Welcome to The Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, and my co-host, Felicity Sidnell Reed. Each week at this time, we visit with a local author. We learn a bit about what they write and why they write it. We take a small glimpse into their lives, and we have an opportunity to hear them read from their work. This week, we're very pleased to welcome Linda Hutzel Manning. Linda's publications include poetry, novels, short fiction, plays, and TV scripts. Linda started writing in the late 70s. She's written and published 11 children's books, but her debut adult novel was published in 2011. At present, she has a poetry collection going the round of publishers, and her novella, Heads I Win, has been shortlisted for Quattro's 2014 Novella Prize. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
You published your first book when you were 41. What motivated you to begin writing at this point in your life?
I was an elementary school teacher. I went to university in my early 30s to get my degree so that I could go back teaching, because it would be much more financially productive for me if I had a degree. And while I was at university, I got enthralled with Canadian literature, and two of my profs started telling me that I should think about being a fiction writer. So instead of being sensible and getting a teaching job, and I would now have a pension, I decided I'd give myself 5 years. I graduated in 75, give myself 5 years to see if I could get something published. And I did do some journalism right away. And then my first book was published in 1981, and then I abandoned teaching completely.
Well, I'm very glad you did. Now, for those first 30 years, you published mainly for children. But in 2011, your first novel for adults came out. So what made you make the switch?
It wasn't really a switch. I graduated with all full of this Canadian literature, never thinking of writing for children. And I started writing short stories right away and getting them rejected. And back in those days, well, it's better now because you can speed things up. You can do online submissions and things, but you could wait 6 or 8 months easily to get a rejection from a publisher. And I had no support group. I didn't know any other writers. And so I was basically on my own. And so the first children's book was just a gift. I was doing housework or something, and these verses came into my head, which became my first children's book. And then it got published, and then I did a couple of children's plays, and they were produced and professionally published and professionally produced. And then I sort of abandoned my idea of writing the great Canadian novel and being a Canadian literary writer. But I did keep writing short stories off and on and some poetry over that whole period, over that whole 30 years. And I did get a few things published, not very many, but it was mainly my main thrust. And then I found out that being a teacher was this incredible asset because I could go into the schools and do workshops. And so there was a whole enterprise built around this, being a children's author. And every once in a while I would think nostalgically, oh, but you know, I wanted to write this novel. And the actual novel grew out of two short stories that had been rejected many, many times. And I put them together because they were linked and created a plot. And then the irony was that after the novel was accepted, both of these short stories placed in competitions. I kept sending them out every once in a while. And you know, such is a writer's life, anyway.
So will you continue and write another adult novel?
Yes, I've started to work on a sequel because it was absolutely terrifying. The very day that I did my launch, and some people had the book ahead of time, people were asking me if there was a sequel, that they were wanting to know what was going to happen to the characters because their lives end and there's still things that are going to happen. And it hadn't even occurred to me to write a sequel, so I was pretty flummoxed to start with, but I denied it vociferously to start with, and then I sort of got into the idea, well, maybe I could write a sequel. And then I spent a good 6 or 8 months. I decided I wasn't going to do a direct sequel. I wasn't going to take the two main characters and carry on with them. I would take two of the minor characters and make them the major characters. So I spent 6 or 8 months researching these people. And then I woke up in the middle of the night about a month ago and said, this is absolute rubbish. I'm not getting anywhere. I'll just go back to the two main characters. So that's what I'm doing.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, the first book was called That Summer in Franklin. Would you like to read for us from that book?
Okay. Franklin is actually a fictional version of Coburg, and anybody that knows Coburg, this is one of the things that people were very taken with because they could figure out Coburg as they were, as I was reading it. It's about two characters, Hannah and Colleen, who it's written in 1995, but then there's flashbacks to 1955 when they were 15 and they worked at the Britannia Hotel. And that's, I'm going to read a short section from about the hotel and about them working there. By the mid-50s, when Colleen Miller and Hannah Norcroft worked there, the hotel was functioning at full capacity. Both Rotary and Masons holding weekly dinner meetings in the recarpeted dining room, and an ongoing clientele of traveling salesmen, businessmen, and itinerant laborers booking into the renovated single rooms upstairs, a number of which contained original Victorian furniture. The Morans kept the third floor for themselves, with private stairs down to the second floor hallway. There, in one of the storage rooms next to the kitchen stairs, Charlie had his room. Years before, whenever Charlie had arrived, and no one knew for certain, Mrs. Bowen, who was the original owner, had converted the storage room into his living quarters. He ate his meals in the kitchen and, as far as anyone knew, used the basement facilities. Mrs. Bowen was adamant that Charlie stay on when the place was sold. Rumor had it she made it a condition of sale. Hugh Moran, who still maintained his U.S. connections, was a shrewd businessman with a seemingly bottomless pocket. He quickly made himself known about town, dropping in at every shop on the main drag to introduce himself, charming the women and impressing the men. He wore stylish suits, often a cravat at his neck, his wavy salt-and-pepper hair a tad longer than stylish for a man of his age. He joined Rotary and promised generous amounts to local charities, gaining confidence and support of even the most conservative small-town thinkers. Deandra Moran, known as Daisy, wore filmy, slightly out-of-date dresses with trailing sleeves and layered skirts. She frequented Sarah Finn's antique shop. Sarah Finn is on the town council. And Sarah made sure that only the best information about the Morans was circulated. Deandra Humphrey had danced in the American Ballet Company until a knee injury forced her to change employment. She told Sarah that she met Hugh while working as an assistant bookkeeper in a classy Chicago hotel. There were several miscarriages before little Larry was born in 1939. Although a sickly baby, he grew rapidly into a lanky boy, tall as his father by the time he was 16. His mother doted on him and told Sarah Finn he was a perfect son. With his father's wavy hair and his mother's aquamarine eyes, he was dubbed the personality kid by the locals at Romer's Restaurant. Larry charmed his teachers, excelling in school every year with little effort or work. He could be arrogant and easily riled up, though, and following too many fights on the way home from sixth grade, Daisy had taken to driving him and picking him up in the Lincoln Continental. Few dared to taunt him, and the one or two he favored were occasionally allowed inside the luxurious vehicle on the way home. Up until the fifth grade, he liked to parade around the hotel foyer after school, sporting his Matchbox models collection, stored in a wooden cigar box. He learned quickly that male patrons loved to admire the tiny cars and trucks, holding them up to inspect their detail and authenticity, often slipping him a quarter for his trouble. Later, he took to building model airplanes in his father's office, bringing them out for appreciation once finished. Since 95% of the weekday clientele was male, his audience was ongoing. Moran watched the boy, feeding his air of superiority and shooing him upstairs only when Daisy insisted. Once the boy turned 14, however, Moran had Larry spend Saturday mornings behind the foyer counter, learning to deal with the public, getting a feel for the business. Dressed in a custom-made suit, his blonde hair slicked back, he charmed everyone. Traveling salesmen kept telling his father the boy was born to sell, while itinerant workers, usually at the hotel for a week or two, tended to flatter him and call him sir. By 1955, Larry was a 16-year-old pro, suave and confident, charming older women and leaning easily into his father's smooth sophistication. Friday afternoons after school, he often swaggered down the main drag smoking a Philip Morris, pilfered from his dad's pack, looking for girls to chat up, returning home only when he knew supper would be ready. He found his mother's continued coddling and embarrassment and figured he was old enough to do whatever he wanted. That summer in Franklin proved to be a turning point for almost everyone at the Britannia Hotel, and as turning points often are, it was random in its choice of victims and relentless in its consequences.
Ooh, that sounds exciting. I wonder what those consequences are. Well, thank you, Linda. And now we'll take a short break.